For our next segment, we're going to go to space. In her new book, Marsha Bartuszak talked to astronomers, historians, and many others to create a collection of astronomical stories. Guiding us in a conversation with Marsha is Seth Mnookin, a journalist, author, and director of MIT's graduate program in science writing. Seth, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Kasia. It's great to be here. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome to the podcast Marsha Bartuszak. Marsha is the author of 8 books and is also a professor in MIT's graduate program in science writing. And today she is here to talk about her latest book, a really wonderful collection of essays called Dispatches from Planet 3, 32 Brief Tales on the Solar System, the Milky Way, and Beyond. Marsha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Seth. It's great to be here.
So, Marsha, can you tell us, what is this book about?
Essentially, this book involves the backstory behind some of the greatest ideas and discoveries in astronomy.
So this book is a little bit different from a lot of your books in that it's not a narrative. It's not sort of telling one story. Can you describe the structure of the book and how you set out to do that?
Yes, it's a collection. It's something I've always wanted to do because this is what I grew up on. I grew up with the collections of Isaac Asimov. I just love the fact that you would have, you'd pick up this book and you'd be able to read a chapter and the next chapter was on something totally different. I always loved that format. I have spent nearly 40 years, I've had the great pleasure of covering the frontiers of astrophysics. And later in my career, I started doing more history, looking back and looking at the origins of some of these astronomical discoveries. And I saw this as an opportunity to put the two together, to meld them.
I thought it was really elegantly put together. In a way, it reminded me a little bit of a book by another one of our colleagues, Alan Lightman, his book, Einstein's Dreams. All of the individual 32 essays that you have are very gripping and poetic and informative in their own right. And then when you read them all together, you get a sum that is definitely greater than all of these individual parts.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your saying that.
Trying to figure out a way for these different essays to fit together, was that a sort of conscious part of the organization process and the writing process, or was that something that kind of became apparent to you after everything started to appear on the page?
I had no agenda with this. I set out a few years ago to take something that was in the news and something that interested me. For example, when Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet in 2006, it reminded me that, you know, this happened before. It happened back in the 19th century when Ceres and Vesta and Pallas and Juno were discovered in the 19th century right past Mars. They were put into the textbooks as planets until they realized they were quite small and they were actually the largest members of what we now call the asteroid belt. But this happened before. We had objects that were called planets that got demoted. So that was one of my stories. That was putting together something that happened and giving the backstory. And then when I put this collection together, that's when I try to start seeing patterns. And one pattern that really surprised me was how many women were part of my backstories. Women, many of them not in the textbooks.
It's interesting that you talk about the role of women, because that was actually one of my questions. It seemed like one of the themes through the book is recognizing the contributions and accomplishments and achievements of women who not only were overlooked during their time, but oftentimes have continued to be overlooked. And I was curious as to whether that was a conscious theme or one that you sort of realized was coming through as you were doing your research. And it sounds like it was the latter, that that was not something that you set out to explore, but that it became apparent as you were working on it that there were these undertold or in some cases not told stories.
Exactly. I actually didn't have that as an agenda. As I said, I let the news set the agenda, and then I would dig into the archives and the back journal papers, and lo and behold, the women are there.
Right.
I love to see that. About a quarter of the stories involve really important discoveries where women were the central linchpin, but they have never been in the spotlight. These women tended to work on their projects without too much publicity. They didn't, you know, ring their bell too much.
Right, right.
And sometimes that's, well, in any endeavor, you know, not just science, but in any endeavor, you have to be a little bit of a showman. I mean, Edwin Hubble was a bit of a showman, and he gets a lot more credit than he deserves. That's another chapter in my book.
Right.
Is there are other men that have not gotten their credit as well. And part of that is you have to be the carnival barker and let people know what you've been doing. And these women tended to really just focus on their work and let the chips fall where they may. But hopefully, and in some cases, they are starting to get recognition. Henrietta Leavitt provided the cosmological yardstick that enabled astronomers to measure distances much farther than they had ever been able to do before. And this enabled Edwin Hubble to discover that indeed there were other galaxies beyond the borders of the Milky Way. He could not have done that without Henrietta Leavitt's work. There was Cecilia Payne Kapochkin, who discovered that hydrogen was the major element of the universe. And that was highly controversial at the time, so much so that they had her take it out of her thesis. And Jocelyn Bell Burnell, who discovered the first neutron star.
Right.
She did not win the Nobel Prize. It was her advisor who won it. But just a couple months ago, she won the $3 million Breakthrough Prize, which is also very prestigious. So slowly, I think these stories are going to hopefully wind their way into the textbook so that the students, the science students, will learn about these accomplishments.
And that prize pays better than the Nobel also, right?
Oh, yeah.
Right.
The Nobel may be around $1 million. This was $3 million.
Right, exactly. So,
which she is totally giving over to scholarships.
Right. That's incredible. I'm interested as to whether in your career as a science writer, you have ever encountered some of those same hurdles to getting recognition that you write about. You know, you write about physics, you write about astronomy, and even though, as we know in our program, a huge number of science writers entering the field and who've been in the field for a long time are female, still at the kind of top levels, it's a field that, when you look at editors, when you look at who gets the big book contracts, it's oftentimes dominated by men. And I'm curious as to whether you have ever encountered an attitude like, oh, well, she can't write about physics. You know, what is a woman doing trying to write about physics?
I have to say, when I first started out in the 1980s, doing science writing full-time, there were the elderly scientists who would see me knocking on their door, coming in, sitting down for the interview, and you could just see in their face that they thought I couldn't possibly understand anything that they were doing. What really helped me is before I started science writing full-time, I had an undergraduate degree in journalism, but because I wanted to write on science, I actually went back to school, loved it so much, I ended up with a master's degree in physics. And that was my ace in the hole. Because when these old timers heard that I had this graduate degree, you could see literally the relief on their face. And that gave me a foot in the door. So I did face a little, you know, a little of that from the older generation. But as the decades went on, I would say in the last few decades, I really haven't had that problem at all. And I think that's also by setting up a track record. If you, as a science writer, establish a track record of not just being both a good writer, but an accurate writer, then that is makes a huge difference for the respect from the community to allow you to come in and snoop around and put your nose into their observations and experiments.
Can you explain the title a little bit, Dispatches from Planet 3? What does that mean, and how did you decide on that?
Yeah, it took a while for my editor and I to come to agreement on what the title of this book was going to be, because they are these separate essays. My working title was Goodnight Cosmos. Because I thought of people having it on their nightstand and picking it up and reading one chapter each night. But they weren't too keen on that. So in the opening chapter of my book, I talk about how over the years our cosmic address has been getting longer and longer and longer. And I actually listed out, it's planet number 3, solar system, Orion Spur on the Sagittarius spiral arm, Milky Way, local cluster, Virgo supercluster, universe, multiverse. We have a really long address. I have no idea what our zip code is.
Right. And it also relates to how the book is structured, because it's not told chronologically. You don't go through and start at the earliest discovery and bring us up to present day. You start essentially at Earth and then work your way outwards. Was that a structure that you came up with right away, or how did you end up with that as the sort of organizing principle?
Yeah, it took me a while. I spent a couple days on it. It was almost like, you know, where you have one of those games of concentration and you have all the index cards all over the table and you're trying to find the right combination. And I thought at first chronological, but then, you know, to go from, say, galactic studies back to Mars or Pluto, it didn't make sense. And I thought maybe the best thing to do would be to give it a sense of location and group my stories, starting with the solar system, then out to the local neighborhood of galaxies and the Milky Way, and then out to the far galaxies, and then on to my more esoteric subjects. At the very last chapter, I talk about the very question of how space and time originated. So it gives you a sense of the great arc of our universe from our local little planet here, planet number 3, out to the Big Bang.
One chapter and one discovery I was really interested in and I thought was really fascinating was your description of how scientists discovered that we were actually in the Milky Way, part of the Milky Way. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, it's really intriguing in that for many years, we could see more clearly out to the distant galaxies than we could see our own Milky Way galaxy. And that's because we are immersed in this disk filled with stars and gas that we literally, it's hard to see through. It's like being on the edge of a china plate and trying to discern the pattern of the china. And so it's taken a long time for us to realize that we live within this spiraling disk of gas and stars. And one of the great breakthroughs was in the 1950s with radio astronomy. That allowed us to use those, collect those radio waves that can go right through the gas as if it's not there, where the light waves are blocked. So that allowed astronomers finally, after many decades of thinking hard of what our local neighborhood looked like, to see that we are part of this beautiful spiraling disk. So we're finally learning a little bit more about our home galaxy, even as we're able to see out to 13 billion light years away.
One of the things that I think is so wonderful about your work generally and this book specifically is you take topics that I think are daunting to a lot of general readers. You know, even just referring to Einstein's theories or what is a black hole or what does it mean for the universe to be constantly expanding? I think that intimidates a lot of readers who might be more comfortable reading about biology or the human body. And you're able to translate it in a way that is not only accessible, but that really captures some of the thrill and the excitement of these discoveries and of this work. And so I'm wondering, it reading it on the page, it seems to flow so naturally. And I was wondering if there was anything that you really struggled to explain, or if there was a phenomena or a researcher or a breakthrough that you just weren't sure how to translate that for an audience that did not have a master's in physics.
My hardest one was the last chapter, where you're really struggling with the merger of general relativity, which you have to explain,
right,
with quantum mechanics, which you have to explain. But, you know, that's what we teach here at MIT at our science writing program, and it's what we tell our students, to take the strange, borrowing words from the New York Times reporter George Johnson, to take the strange and make it familiar. So we're not teaching science. That's not my concern. But what we have to do is try to find something in our everyday life that will make the mechanisms, the processes of science, to be familiar to the layman. And that's what I'm struggling with. For example, in that chapter, I mentioned that they are now thinking that time is not a real property, that it just emerges. Sort of like air pressure, that it doesn't exist on the tiniest of scales, but exists and comes out slowly, almost like a crystallization. And so I use the idea of a pointillist painting, where you have all these separate little dots that if you look at it real close up, you can't discern anything. But as you pull back, you can then view the larger picture. And so the analogy then is that time also has no definition. We can't tell time on the smallest of scales, sub-microscopic scales. But as you pull back into our larger world, into the whole universe, time finally has a definition and a place. So that's what you're looking to do. That's basically what I've been doing for 40 years, is explanatory journalism. And that's what I'm always looking for, to find that metaphor or analogy that will make people comfortable and slap their head and say, oh my gosh, I can understand quantum chronodynamics.
Right.
And then I feel I've been successful. I wanted to add one more thing, is that you always want to tell a story to find the narrative, especially when you're dealing with the hard sciences like physics and astronomy. To find a story, to put the human element into there, is so essential at the same time. And that's what I'm also trying to balance, is not only bringing in the metaphors and analogies, but to convey to people that this is a human enterprise with all the foils and fables and that involve any other human activity. Science is a human enterprise. It is not just this pristine thing off in a corner with people in white lab coats. They are people, and to bring those stories in as well is very important to reaching a wider audience.
And actually from that, did you have any particular story that was your favorite? Either your favorite to learn about, your favorite to write, your favorite to play around with?
I have to say I have a real, well, I think there's two. One is the dark matter story, because I was in on it so early. I wrote when I was doing magazine features back in the 1980s, was one of the first to write on dark matter. In fact, it wasn't even known as dark matter yet. It was known as the missing mass. I had done it so early. And to be able to see how that mystery has just been, evolving and changing over the decades, and it's still not solved. But I really, the story I love the most is on gravitational wave astronomy, because in the late 1990s, before anybody else was willing to write on this topic, I was right at the LIGO observatories, the gravitational wave observatories, as they were under construction. And I was able to talk to all the people who were at the very foundation and beginning of that enterprise. And that's what I loved. I had gotten into science writing thinking I was part of the cleanup operation, that right. All the different arenas of astronomy had already been done. And here I found something totally new, had never been done before, and I was in on the ground floor. And to be able to see that field develop and know the people personally and interact with them over 20 years, and see them come to the great detection, the first detection of a gravitational wave predicted by Einstein more than 100 years ago, that was my favorite. Absolutely.
Right. Marcia Bartuszak, it's been really wonderful talking with you and talking about your new book, Dispatches from Planet 3, 32 Brief Tales on the Solar System, the Milky Way, and Beyond. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And I can't wait to see what you're going to work on next. And hopefully we can have you back and talk about that as well.
Thank you, Seth. I enjoyed it immensely.
Okay, On Dark listeners, that's all for this month. Thank you for joining us. We're produced by Lydia Chain. Music in Celine Ross's piece was done by Lee Rosevere, while music for the rest of the podcast was done by the Undark team. I'm your host, Kasia Patel, and see you next month.